thing we have to fear is fear itself. Fear itself. Fear itself.
From the Center for History and New Media at George Mason University, this is Digital Campus, a biweekly discussion of how digital media and technology are affecting learning, teaching, and scholarship at colleges, universities, libraries, and museums.
Ask not what your country can do for you. Ask what you can do for your country. Fear itself.
This is Digital Campus number 13 for the 21st of September 2007. Everything in moderation? I'm Dan Cohen. Well, we've done it, Tom and Mills. We are on episode 13 and a half year of podcasting. We can all celebrate at this point. Welcome to the 13th episode, Lucky 13, of Digital Campus. We are here with much greater sound fidelity over our high-speed Internet 2 networks here at George Mason University, the Center for History and New Media. I'm Dan Cohen, and I'm here with Tom Scheinfeld of foundhistory.org. Hi, Tom.
Hey, Dan.
And Mills Kelly of edwire.org. Hey, Mills.
Hi, Dan. How are you?
Very good. And, of course, I can be found at dancohen.org, and welcome to the podcast. New listeners of the new semester and our faithful listeners who've been with us from the beginning. We'd like to welcome you back, and we're going to kick right off with our regular opening segment, which is the news roundup. And there were a lot of stories this week around online and free Office applications that compete with Microsoft's near monopoly of their OpenOffice, or excuse me, their Office suite. These are applications that, of course, we use all the time, things like Word and PowerPoint, which I always have to shudder when I say, and email applications as well. In fact, on email, it looks like the founders of the Firefox web browser have spun off Thunderbird, which was sort of a really playing a second fiddle as their email application to Firefox, and so Mozilla has now spun that off as a company. I can't remember if it's, I guess it's sort of for-profit, but they're not aggressively for-profit. Is that right?
I think it's going to be four. I think it's probably, at least from what I understand, it's along the same model as the Firefox Corporation, which is a for-profit company that's wholly owned by the Mozilla Foundation. So it's actually called the Mozilla Corporation. But I think they may – I wonder if they're going to change the name to Firefox Corporation and then have Thunderbird Corporation so that they're sort of separate entities, so that the profits all get rolled back into the Mozilla Foundation.
Got it. That makes a lot of sense. I mean, they're really known as a kind of one-trick pony at this point with Firefox, and I'm sure a lot of the energy goes into Firefox. So this seems like a good move for them to create a separate entity that can really solely focus on Thunderbird, which is a competitor to Apple Mail and the ubiquitous Microsoft Outlook. We noticed that also Google launched their presentation part of their online Office suite. And at the same time, IBM released an open source suite called Symfony, a beautiful sounding name for some existing software. Of course, the OpenOffice.org suite of open source tools, very popular, often comes in different flavors, sold and distributed by different companies and entities. And Yahoo bought Zimbra, which is a big sort of email and collaborative calendaring system. So they're going to fold that in, I think, to their Yahoo Mail system as well. So it seems like a lot of competition for Microsoft this week. In addition, they were sort of received an interesting and painful smackdown by the European courts. And I think this was also an interesting story that kind of brackets all these other stories about, you know, the role for government regulators in Europe, the much more aggressive role that they're taking in terms of beating down near monopolies in the tech industry. And I think what was interesting is that probably here on Digital Campus, We like to see bad news about Microsoft, and certainly all of the things I just mentioned are bad news in a way for Microsoft, which makes a considerable amount of profit from its Office suite. But this ruling in Europe really means that they're going to get very aggressive for not only for Microsoft, but other tech companies that achieve very high sort of near monopoly rates of adoption. You can think already about Microsoft was criticized and ultimately sued in Europe for adding in a media player when Real Networks had a competing product and was out in front. And then, of course, Microsoft, in the same way that they crushed Netscape by including Internet Explorer in every copy of Windows, simply just added Windows Media Player, and that pretty much did in Real, although, of course, Real's still around. But Europe didn't like it that much. And so you wonder about, Google adding, for instance, new features to a search engine that really take on independent companies. Even their productivity suite, their Office apps compete with independent companies like Zoho, which has a terrific set of, very similar sorts of online applications. And Apple, of course, with their iPod, you need to wonder what happens there when they've got 85 or 90% of the market. What will happen to them in Europe as they sort of continue to expand iTunes and into more areas? Tom and Mills, what was your take on all these stories, and what is the future for the Microsoft Office suite? It's still really the standard, isn't it? I mean, we ask for instance, applications, in Word format, or it's the most common format that's tossed around between collaborators.
I think this is the thing that Microsoft has been afraid of for probably 5 or 6 years, and it's finally really starting to come to pass, largely because big companies like Google are really taking it seriously as a possibility. I mean, for a long time, I can't remember now how long it's been since the first time I saw the prediction that the internet eventually would go to this sort of model of applications running off of servers of various companies rather than having to buy the software and run it on your computer yourself. And so
there's been so many waves of that, haven't there?
Yeah.
I mean, every 5 years you think it's there, that thin client model.
Well, that was supposed to be the revolution that with Java in the kind of early and mid 90s was that, we'd all be running thin clients and running these Java apps on our thin clients, but never happened.
But I think the big difference now is that you've got a company with the strength of Google behind it and the technical capability of Google. So, Google can actually, they have the resources, both fiscal and also technological, to make it happen. And so I think that's really what's going to make the difference. The question is, will people buy into it, or do they feel more comfortable owning a copy of the software themselves?
I think the other question is really, can they get the software? How long will it take them to get the software up to speed? And are they rolling it out too soon? I know that from what I've seen of the new PowerPoint, the new presentation software that Google's rolled out, it's really not a substitute in any way for PowerPoint. I don't use PowerPoint very much myself, but I actually think the Google Docs are actually pretty good. But you need a lot less computing power and sophistication to build an online and run an online word processor than you do to run an online graphics and graphing and video, audio, presentation software. And from what I've seen of the Google presentation software, it's not there yet. And the question then becomes like, okay, well then you roll it out too quickly. Bunch of people try it. They find out it's kind of cheesy and clunky, and the presentations come out kind of ugly and amateurish. Do they say, forget this, I'm going back to PowerPoint, and never come back? That's one of these things where I think in this online environment with running web services, and I think this applies to digital humanists running web services, you can release too early. Because, you've really got one shot at people, I think. People will come and try your product. If they try it the first time and don't like it, it's really hard to get them back to try revision 2.
Boy, that's really the case. I mean, people who beta tested Zotero last fall, I've now seen updated blog posts where these people have sort of come back to the, you know, to the software and, you know, haven't realized that we've done this enormous amount of development in the past year and realize there are all these new features. But you're right. You sort of, you know, with so much going on in the Web 2.0 space, all these new companies and new online applications, people do kind of test things once and move on. I wonder, though, are we talking about apples and oranges here? I mean, isn't, you know, I guess the IBM Symfony story, there is a direct competitor, right? I mean, that's downloaded applications. It's really a direct replacement for your, you know, for your installation that runs on your computer that you can take on an airplane and, you know, exchange documents with other people across the network. But Google Docs, it strikes me, you know, and indeed their whole suite is, isn't it for kind of more collaborative space than Microsoft? I mean, isn't it about, you know, you're not going to get the formatting because Google Docs drives me insane with its formatting and, you know, trying to delete, for instance. Sometimes the delete key doesn't work like you would imagine. You can't delete a line for some reason. But if you're just interested in the content and not the layout and these sorts of things that we're used to, kind of that are leftovers from the print world of, you know, I need that specific font and I want to have lots of fonts and I want to be able to do a three-column view really easily and, you know, create a newsletter on it. If you're not concerned with that, if you're more concerned with, okay, I need some text and, you know, I'm working on it, and Mills, you might have to take a look at it at some point, and then Tom, you want to write the second half. Google Docs really excels at that, and isn't that the kind of market they're looking for? That not the finished product, but the collaboration angle?
I think that's true, and I think that's definitely true for Google Docs, which is why I think it actually really does work. I think the presentation software, when you start to get into that, because there you are building a finished product. That's the whole point of the presentation software, is to build a presentation that you will, and the layout is everything, and the presentation and the fonts and the colors and the graphics and the charts and the graphs and all that. That is the point of it. And so there, I'm a little more skeptical, but yeah, I agree. I think maybe it's not a direct competitor. Maybe it's a supplement or just a different market, a different kind of client.
The other thing I would say is, you know, to go back just for a minute to Dan's point about, well, if you don't get it right, or Tom's point, when you don't get it right the first time, then people aren't going to come back. I think that's true in the United States. I think it's true in Europe. I don't think it's true in Central America. I don't think it's true in Africa. I don't think it's true in Southeast Asia, where, I mean, when I was in Cambodia back in the spring, I bet Microsoft has only sold hundreds of copies of its Office suite in Cambodia, in a country of 30 million people.
Right.
They're going to use the Google Docs and not worry about the fact that it's a little clunky. So I think there is really
they're going to use the pirated version.
certainly there
right.
are probably.
But now they don't need to. There are free versions, right?
Right. I'm sure that there are thousands of pirated versions floating around, but you know, the freeware is going to make, I think, a really big difference also in the developing world.
I think that's a great point.
I think that what's also going to make a difference is when they get Google Gears up, really up and running, which is really just in beta now, but they need to get the airplane market, the offline market, the,
yep,
you know, don't always have Wi-Fi market, and that's going to require them with Gmail, with Google Docs, with the presentation software in particular, because, you know, I know when we go to meetings, you know, the American Historical Association, you're not going to have a web connection from, you know, your point of presentation. You need it on a USB key, and or you need it on your laptop that's not online. And so what Google Gears will do for them is the ability to run this stuff offline, and then when you do have an internet connection, sync it back up.
I just don't understand it with Google Gears, and maybe I'm not getting it. Like, I get it, like, right now the only thing it really works with is Google Reader. And I get how it works with Google Reader. You know, it's saving it, you know, it's using the Firefox SQLite back end, and so it's saving it in a little table where, you know, you have it's got my 200 items for my feed reader, unread items, and it's got, you know, the text of the post and the title and the date. And that's a pretty simple table, and it doesn't take up much space and everything. How are they going to do that with Gmail? Like, I've got 50,000 emails in with attachments in my Gmail. How are they going to make Google Gears with the Firefox SQLite database? How are they going to make that work? Isn't it going to be so slow to do the syncing and the you know, the upload and the download? It just seems I just don't see it happening anytime soon. And that was that's actually another story that's kind of out and about today, is that Google Gears for Gmail is going to be coming out soon. Now, that may be just a rumor, but I'll believe it when I see it.
Well, Tom, actually, I'll throw out the first link for our show then. If you want a vision of the future, this is not from Google, but a third-party application that does just this. It's called Mailplane for OS X or OS X. And it's just that Mailplane app, like mailplaneapp.com. And it's a Mac client for Gmail, and it is really strange. It's got the Mac trimming, so menu bars, all this stuff, and inside of it you actually view what looks exactly like Gmail, and you can take it on the plane and it works just fine.
Really, it's an offline client.
Yeah, it does it offline, and you can even drag and drop attachments like you do in Apple Mail onto the window, which you can't do in a web browser, and it just will add it as an attachment.
Because I heard about it early on when it first launched, and I don't think it had that offline capability. That's amazing.
Yeah.
Okay.
I'm gonna check that out.
Yeah.
But they're not using the back end that Google Gears has, which you know, we don't need to get too technical, but really is sort of a database back end, which makes a lot of sense for, like as you said, for a news reader. And I guess in some ways makes sense for mail, but then you do have this problem of attachments and all this stuff that you need. So it'll be interesting to see what they can do to get these things offline, but I'm sure this is where they're going. And at that point, then they're in a really competitive space because they have the online offline thing. And that's what's a real killer app, I think.
Yeah. And they're clearly way smarter than me. So
right.
if anybody can do it, they can.
Right. Well, it looks like at the very least, we will not be paying much for these important Office applications in the very near future, one way or another, whether we use Symfony or Google Apps or Zoho or Zimbra or any of these other applications. And also this week, it looks like we're not going to be paying much for premium content anymore either. There's been a lot of buzz about the New York Times basically doing away with Time Select, which was their... really what I guess was an experiment to see if they could charge visitors to NewYorkTimes.com for some of the quote-unquote premium content. And by that, they meant op-eds and certain parts of each section. And I think, you know, they seem to have some success on this front. From what I read, there were about 250,000 paying members of Time Select. I mean, I was a member of Time Select, but I get home delivery of the physical paper, so I think there was another 700,000 or 800,000 Time Select users that were getting home subscriptions and signed up for Time Select for free. So they were making some money, but decided, no, the future is really in free content online. Sort of dovetails interestingly with what we discussed last week with the New York Times setting up an online learning company, essentially, and trying to get more paid content that way. And of course, then immediately there was speculation that Rupert Murdoch would, as part of one of his initial fiats over at the Wall Street Journal, would actually make that open up as well. And they actually have many more subscribers at, I think, $100 a year for their online content. What do you think the significance is on this, of these major institutions like the New York Times and Wall Street Journal opening up? I think it's going to feed nicely into our feature segment as well.
I think it's very significant because I think that they've finally had to bow to the demand of the market, which is, well, if it's not free, I'm not going to look at it. It's just, I mean, in particular, I get this from my students. They just aren't going to pay for content online. They've come through this system for the last 5 or 6 years where there is a tremendous amount of free content that is perfectly good. And so since what they found is perfectly good, why would they pay for premium service. I mean, there are businesses where that's true. I'm sure that that is the entire business model of the pornography industry online. But there's so much free. Why would you pay for information content that just seems marginally better to the average user? So I think that they've kind of had to recognize that the average person on the internet just doesn't make the kind of premium, not premium distinction about information.
I think there's also a tension with the internet, and I read this somewhere. Maybe it's like O'Reilly. I should probably source this better, but that there's a tension on the internet with gated content, and I think this goes just as much for gated scholarly resources, educational resources, ProQuest, things like that, as it does for the New York Times. Maybe not quite as much so, but same idea that when everything is linked to everything else, you can't have some things that are behind a wall and some things that aren't. Like, I know that the blogosphere got really angry with the Times for gating some of its content because you're a political blogger and you're blogging and you want to like comment on Maureen Dowd's piece, and you know, you put a link to it up and only, you know, 3% of your readership can actually get there. So that's like a real problem with this kind of, if they want to be major players in the kind of blogosphere in this world of social media and sharing information and all the things that the internet is, they can't be gating some of their content.
I mean, you can do a really interesting experiment on this. You know, go to Technorati or Google Blog Search and get a feed for blog posts that link to NewYorkTimes.com. to articles at NewYorkTimes.com. And your feed reader will instantly fill with hundreds of things a day. I mean, they were getting all these link backs that after 2 weeks, or perhaps not at all, no one could actually view the article. I mean, they're turning away readers. They're turning away advertising eyeballs, you know, for just this relatively small number of people.
And because nobody finds an old blog post, finds a link to a New York Times article, clicks on that link, finds that it's gated, and says, oh yeah, I'll pay the, you know, $80 or whatever to subscribe, or $20 to subscribe or whatever. They just say, oh, I'll go somewhere else.
That's right. And you know, they're in the business of maintaining a certain kind of premier reputation. And also, you know, I'm sure that they looked at the advertising dollars, and that, you know, despite the burst of the .com bubble, that's now come way back up. And, you know, I think you can just project that into the future and look at your server logs and how many people you're turning away for viewing, you know, all these link backs and page views that you're missing out on because your stuff is gated. I imagine that, you know, there was a lot of agitation even before this happened, you know, especially, you know, among the people who, you know, in the New York Times business unit who really understood, you know, what this meant to, like, give away these free eyeballs that were being linked back to their site. And not only that, these articles last for years and years and years. I mean, you Google search some things, you'll get New York Times articles now, and you couldn't before.
Right.
You know, they have permanent URLs for these articles, and so you're just missing out on all that Google traffic that someone Googles a particular topic, and, you know, if the New York Times had an article about that, they wouldn't get any of that traffic. So I think this makes a lot of sense, and I think it'll be interesting to see if others open up as well. I guess the Wall Street Journal is the biggest, but there are probably others as well, right? Economist.
Economist is gated.
Washington Post is gated.
Right. Or at least you have to sign up for an account.
Well, it's not. Yeah, they don't charge you, but you still have to go through the process of signing up for an account, which in the example that Tom gave is the same problem. I mean, if you click on a blog post, you read the link, you see a link to WashingtonPost.com story, you click on the link and you can't get in, are you actually going to go to the trouble of registering for the site just to read it? I think a lot of people won't.
Right. Well, it sounds like open is king, and that actually leads into our featured story. For our future segment today, we wanted to spin out some thoughts from a discussion, or really rather a debate, that came about because of a blog post from our own Mills Kelly on the podcast. And Mills, you had a post about HNET, which for people who are not in history may not know HNET, but it's a very widely used and really has been around for, what, I guess about a decade. Is that right, Mills?
Yeah, about a decade.
Listserv, really, so an email discussion group for that's separated into various fields. So there's, for instance, I read HSciMed Tech, which is about the history of science, technology, and medicine. And I think there's well over 100 of these groups. And Mills, you had a post on, you know, the past, present, and future of HNET, and particularly in relation to blogs. And it really had to do with this issue of making scholarly materials open and available. We should say HNET is totally free. Anyone can go to HNET and sign up. But on the other hand, it isn't available in the same way that sort of Washington Post articles aren't really available or visible on the web. Do you want to explain your thinking a little bit about that, and we'll talk from there.
Sure, sure. Well, first of all, just to kind of clarify on the availability issue with HNET, and a little bit more on the kind of background of the organization. HNET is really, it's more than a listserv. It's really a cluster of networked communities of scholars. I guess there are more than 100 different listservs that are under the HNET umbrella. And they are really all over the scholarly map in humanities, social sciences, technology, education. And some of them are quite small with a small number of members, you know, in the dozens. Others are quite large with, I know for sure, one has at least 13,000 members who are receiving email through the list on a regular basis. So they, you know, they really range in size and amounts of traffic on the list. The second thing has to do with the availability issue. You can go to the HNET website and you can search the discussion logs through a kind of clunky search process where you have to search each log by month. But you can do it and search through the posts in any one of the different scholarly communities represented there and read what was posted on the list. So it is open in that sense and accessible, not easily accessible, but accessible. And then the second thing, though, is that they blocked access to all of those posts, those tens of thousands or hundreds of thousands of posts in their archive, but they blocked the major search engines from them. So an HNET posting never turns up in Google, for instance, unless it's been reposted somewhere else, like on somebody's blog or on a website. So that's one issue about accessibility. The other is not everybody can belong to an HNET list. They are closed communities, moderated lists. And so, for instance, one of the lists that I've been involved in for a long time, Habsburg, because I'm a Habsburg historian, and I actually was the teaching editor of that list for several years, undergraduate students are generally barred from the list. And so it's really grad students and professors and then other interested scholars, I guess is maybe the way that they put it. But so that's not really an open community of interest the way that other websites, other kinds of social networking opportunities might be. So they are closed communities by choice. And so that, you know, it's really kind of a restricted conversation that goes on among scholars there.
Mills, if I could just interrupt you there. I mean, the defenders of HNET and indeed, you know, the three of us know that that closure or whatever you want to call it, partial closure, had significant advantages for many years, and indeed many believe it continues to have advantages. And in that, the moderation helped to obviously keep out spam, but also to, you know, keep the discussion level high, or on point at least. So posts that were really off topic were kept off the list. It acted as a filter. We have filters all throughout academia, in journal editors and peer review. What is the problem there? I mean, why? What has changed? And what are your concerns?
Well, I have kind of two concerns about it, and that I raised in the blog post. One is this question of accessibility. And so, if the material, if it's a closed conversation among a small community of scholars, then that really shuts out the sort of general public from the conversation. And so we end up as scholars just kind of talking to ourselves about things that we already know a fair amount about. There's some advantages to those sorts of semi-private conversations, and there are some disadvantages in that we don't tend to get a lot of new perspectives. I mean, I'm bothered by the lack of accessibility for undergraduate students, for instance, as though somehow they don't have something to contribute. But the bigger issue that I raised in the blog post that kind of set off this discussion was about the future of email as the delivery system for scholarly content, because that's what HNET is based on, the email model. All of the material comes as not just email, but plain text email. So if you if you're working in a language that uses diacritical marks in the language, all of those words that require diacritical marks are misspelled, because email just won't do that, or at least the kind of email server that they're using won't do that. So and also, I started my blog post with the question of, do you get too much email? Because certainly I do, and I think just about everybody listening to this podcast gets too much email. And so I wondered whether email was really the right way to maintain these scholarly communities, and suggested that there were now other kinds of platforms like blogs and wikis and other sorts of social networking platforms that would allow scholars to have the same sort of interchange of information, and they could do it still in this sort of semi-closed way that HNET is, only letting in quote-unquote reputable people. I guess grad students and faculty members are by definition reputable, but letting those people, only those people could comment or, you know, whatever. But so it could be that closed in that way, or it could be more open and really give sort of a wider frame for the discussion. So my speculation was that that email is probably, as a method for delivering content, is probably on its way out, and so HNET ought to start thinking of other ways to build the same kinds of scholarly communities that it had 5 years ago, 3 years ago, around some of these new platforms. And I also asked the question, kind of an empirical question, which was, what's happening to the traffic on their list? Now, you can go to hnet.org/stats and get the results of the stats program that they run. And I would say that those stats are pretty much useless, because they're cumulative stats from the beginning and on a daily basis. And so, you know, there are 3 million and some odd messages that have been posted in the last year or something like that. It just doesn't actually tell you anything about the traffic on the individual lists. So I went to the kind of the brute force method and went to their logs for 4 different lists and counted the traffic on those lists. And I didn't just pick them at random. These were lists that I have either subscribed to or know that other people find very useful, and they've been fairly active in the past. And 3 of those 4 lists have had a decline in traffic over the last 3 years for the same 3-month period of time I looked at. And one of them was flat over that period of time. So so that raised the question in my mind of, well, is their model really starting to show signs of strain? And it set off really a fairly interesting discussion from people about whether email was the right way to go or not.
Yeah, and we'll post to HNET and also to some of these online discussions about this. Again, just playing it from the side of HNET, you know, I think some of the arguments for are, first of all, probably first and foremost, just the barrier to entry question of, you know, everyone has email, we know how to use it to post to HNET. You simply, you know, put in the address for your particular list and send it off, and it goes to the moderator, and the moderator accepts it. It gets passed along to the entire list. But, you know, and there are other arguments as well in terms of, you know, the importance of closure. You know, I say this obviously with some note of skepticism, since I do think that the technology has moved on. And we should say, in all fairness, it sounded to me, Mills, and you can confirm this, but it sounds to me like these very discussions are going on within HNET, as I assume they're going on within all listserv communities and you know, including old-style forums and these sorts of things that blogs and other technologies have overtaken. That's right, right?
Yes, yeah, I heard from a number of senior people at HNET after I posted the thing in my blog, and several of them indicated that they were having these kinds of discussions, but that thus far those discussions really haven't gone anywhere.
Right. And, you know, now I think the issue is, well, there's several issues. I mean, the barriers to entry for something like a blog are extraordinarily low. I mean, Mills, you and I, we both have all of our students blogging, and you know, I at this point, I have no problem getting anyone online. It literally, if you can sign up for an email account, you can sign up for a blog and start blogging. So it, that's quite simple. The you know, the big issue that you brought up is, you know, searchability and findability. You know, having, for instance, each post on HNET be a distinct URL that has a page would be enormously helpful, because then you could refer to it from other places. And, you know, that's what we're kind of getting used to in this quote-unquote Web 2.0 world is, we want to be able to point to fixed, you know, permanent URLs for objects that, you know, that we want to cite. And
well, they do have fixed URLs for each one of those posts through their logs, but finding that is what's hard.
It's still currently not crawled by Google. In other words, correct. If you search, okay, huh. And that's one of the things that blogs do really well is, actually on my blog, if I post something, it's available not only in Google blog search, but actually the main Google index, generally within 24 hours.
Sure.
Because Google knows that, okay, it's a blog, it's updated more frequently than other kinds of sites, and they ping my site a few times a day. So, you get that. You know, there is the question of elitism, which I thought was an interesting one. Tom, you know, your blog is really oriented toward a more popular audience, you know, within and outside of academia. What's your take? I assume you'd want HNET to open up a bit more than they currently are.
I think I would like HNET to open up a bit more than they are. Although I think where I come down on this is that I think that email has some things to recommend it. And one of those things from a community building standpoint is once somebody's signed up to your list, you know that they get that email every time it's sent out, and you know that it goes to their inbox. You know it's delivered to them. So it's this kind of push mechanism, whereas with blogs, they still have to pull the content from you to some extent. RSS readers is pushing the content to them to some extent, but it's less of a guarantee that they're getting the content. Now, you know, you could argue that you know, people should have the choice whether they want to get the content every day and every time or not. But I think as a moderator for one of these communities, you know that the people are getting the material. I think also if anybody's ever signed up for a listserv and then tried to unregister for the listserv, you know that it's kind of hard. And it's, you know, I'd be interested to see with HNET's lists just how many people are members of these communities and but only because they just haven't gotten around to unsubscribing. I mean, I think there's this kind of constraint of, you know, you have to go back to the welcome email that's sitting, you know, somewhere at the bottom of your saved message folder and figure out what command you're supposed to send to sign off the list. And so I think, I mean, from a community building point of view, that's in some ways a positive, although it might be a negative to the users. So that's one thing. But I think we can overstate the extent to which, you know, these Web 2.0 technologies, the blogs and the Ning and these social networking platforms are going to replace email. I mean, I think whenever any new technology comes along, especially communications technologies, I think the history of technology is rife with these examples. Everybody says, oh, well, you know, TV is going to be the death of radio. Well, we see that radio is still around. It may not be quite as prominent as it was before television came around, but it's still around. And it works very well for certain things. I mean, you know, like, you know, video didn't totally kill the radio star, but to the extent that it did, you know, talk radio replaced that. And radio, in many respects, is the best place if you want political talk. Because it's just the technology is just very well suited to political talk. And really, if you're going to have a 24-hour political network, radio is probably the best place to do it, not TV. I mean, the talk radio stations are doing much, much better than MSNBC and CNN. So maybe TV isn't the right place for that. Maybe radio is. And I think we're still in the process, you know, as the internet in general, but also, you know, scholars and educators and public historians and public other public cultural professionals. We're still in the process of figuring out, like, what is email good for? What are blogs good for? What is social networking good for? And how do these technologies kind of mix? So I think that's where we are. And so I think it's kind of hard to say whether email is dead or even how far it will die.
Yeah, I agree, Tom. I think, you know, this is a process of figuring out the advantages and disadvantages of each technology. I think where I had kind of a problem with the defenders of HNet this week were those who were saying there's not serious scholarship going on blogs. And it's amazing to me that after all these years of you know, the existence of blogs, that there's still this feeling, and I've blogged about this. In fact, the most popular post on my blog is called Professors Start Your Blogs, and it's all about how there's a sort of legacy of the early years of blogging that, for some reason, this myth still sticks around that, you know, blogs are about what you ate for breakfast that morning, or, you know, if you're a teenager, what current lusts you have. You know, and there's now a very serious body of academics blogging. You know, if you look at the library community, there are very great, serious library blogs, lots of them, hundreds, thousands of them. If you look at an area like the law, there are law blogs that have literally tens of thousands of subscribers that are reviewing, really within days, articles that come out in the major law reviews. So they provide a much more extensive feedback section than some of these journals, even if the journals are online. And then you have preprint services like archive.org for the natural sciences that are doing an amazing job sort of taking forward the idea of, you know, putting out serious scholarship in a kind of, you know, quick, online, fully available way. And I think it's really starting to change some of these fields. I mean, certainly it's changed the field of physics and mathematics. I mean, you've had advances come out on archive.org before they're published anywhere else. I mean, major advances show up there. And I think it's only a matter of time. I think the humanities are really far behind, that this is going to start happening, that there'll be a blog post that will be really important in some field of let's say, history. And I think it's more likely to happen on a blog where you have the ability to do images and, you know, a bit longer form than you could do in an email. And also have the ability for comments directly on that particular article that you post to your blog. That seems to me to have a lot of advantages.
The other problem with email is a delivery system through the listserv software is that what you just said, something about images. I mean, on these HNet lists, you can't get any images, you can't get any video files. It's only plain text.
Yeah, and I just don't see how. I mean, I don't think that on, you know, there's tremendous scholarship happening on listservs either. I mean, a lot of the things that are happening on listservs are, you know, answers to people are asking and answering, you know, relatively, you know, important to them, but still relatively mundane questions like, does anybody have a source on, you know, such and such a topic, or can anybody point me in the right direction to somebody to talk to about X, Y, or Z? So it's not like, you know, people are writing, you know, full blown journal articles on HNet lists either.
Yeah. Well, I guess we'll have to keep track of this. You know, I think, you know, it remains to be seen. I think certainly Mills, you mapped out, I think, some changes that HNet could make, and surely HNet will have to change somewhat. But, you know, of course, I'm sure the debate within HNet is also that any change incurs loss, and there'll be some people who will be quite fussy about losing email or moving into an RSS reader or any of those things. It's hard to know how to move forward from here.
Yeah, that certainly fussy would be the right word. I got a few fussy responses to the whole thing, but there certainly will be a loss for the people who I think who will get lost are the people who only want the push. You know, they just want to have the stuff show up in their email inbox, and they don't actually want to transfer this whole process to a feed reader or something like that. And so I think that what we'll see is some sort of a kind of a transitional period. And I think that, and it may be that blogs ultimately end up, instead of having an RSS feed, they may also have some sort of an email feed where they're, you know, sending things regularly to subscribers that way. Who knows?
Well, if the audience would like to get fussy with us on this issue, please, of course, join us online at digitalcampus.tv and write in some comments for episode 13. It's time once again for Picks of the Week. Tom, let's start with you this week.
All right. I have another podcast here to recommend. It's actually a radio program that is also made available now as a podcast. People in the UK will be familiar with this. Maybe people in the US and other places not as much so. It's called In Our Time, and it's a history podcast from the BBC. It's very British. It's a little dry, but it brings together usually three scholars with the host Melvin Bragg for an hour, and it comes out about once a week, usually I think during the winter, and I think they take a recess during the summer. To talk about issues mostly in intellectual history. And the discussions are usually, you know, very, very rich for a podcast, certainly, very highbrow, and usually very good. And he gets very, very good scholars on the program. So maybe don't listen to it while you're driving if you're worried about falling asleep at the wheel. Certainly not late at night, because it does get a little long winded. But it is very, very good, very high quality. And if people want to see not a commercial radio broadcast, but a mainstream radio broadcast that is incredibly high quality and very well done, have a listen to In Our Time.
Yeah, it's a great podcast. You know, it was one of the first podcasts I ever downloaded was In Our Time on Renaissance geometry, and it was so good I could not believe it. So great pick there, Tom. Mills, what do you have for us this week?
Mine is a blog called Strange Maps. I don't know if either of you have ever seen this, but it's strangemaps.wordpress.com, and it's a blog about unusual cartography, and some of it historical, some of it not, some of it humorous. You know, I was looking at one the other day, which is a Texans map of the United States, where Texas occupies about 2/3 of the landmass of the lower 48, and the state just to the north that Texans don't even like to mention is the state of Misery, and Illinois is Illinois, and things like that. There are various maps. There's a very humorous one from Punch of John Bull sending bum boats toward France, and you can perhaps get the idea of what a bum boat is. And so there's one of the internet's black holes. You know, China is black in this map. So they have all sorts of different takes on cartography that not only the creator of the blog has put in, but other people have pointed him to. And so it's an academic's take, or kind of a more precise take on this cartography. It's not just, hey, look at this funny map, but here's a map, here's the context within which it was produced, here's what it's saying. And so it's really useful with students. This semester I'm teaching a variety of courses on the Cold War in Eastern Europe, and so they have in this blog a Stalin's map of what Central Europe was going to look like if the American and British forces hadn't gotten into Germany by 1945. So, you know, that's a very interesting discussion piece.
Wow, this is great. I just pulled it up on my browser. Terrific. I've got a map of plastics, plastic world, and that Texans map of the United States where California is listed as uninhabitable. Looks awfully good. Great mix of sort of popular maps and also some terrific historical content. Well, I'm going to join in the maps meme this week with the launch of last week we talked about the launch of Yahoo Teachers, and this week they launched what I think is just a terrific product, this map mixer. I don't know if the two of you saw this, but it is a site where you can upload your own map. So if you scan in a map, or if you have another map that's already in a digital format, you can very easily upload it. I mean, it's just as easy as finding the map on your hard drive and uploading it. and then you can place it onto Yahoo Maps and use what's called point matching, which is a very standard system for sort of stretching a map to fit onto another map. You can place it right on top of Yahoo Maps and zoom in, zoom out. I think it's really, really useful for the classroom, for scholarship, if you want to, you know, take a look at, you know, a historic map and sort of map it onto an existing city. It works extremely well. It's very easy to use. And, you know, I'd encourage everyone to try it out if you're interested in maps. And, you know, this is possible in other platforms, but the actual placing and matching up points tends to be harder than it is here. So I have to give kudos to Yahoo for Map Mixer. And of course, as we do on every podcast, we will have links to all these sites on our website, digitalcampus.tv. And as we said in our feature segment, we hope to see you all there. Of course, you can email us. We do indeed read email, despite what we just said in the feature segment. We will get email any email you send to us. I think it's feedback@digitalcampus.tv. And otherwise, if we don't hear from you there online or via email, we will hear from you in 2 weeks on another episode of Digital Campus.
The only thing we have to fear is fear itself. Fear itself. Fear itself.
Please visit us online at digitalcampus.tv, where you can join in the discussion and let us know about stories and issues you would like us to cover on future episodes. Mike O'Malley wrote our theme music.
Ask not what your country can do for you. Ask what you can do for your country. Fear itself.